Welcome to If You Love This Planet. I'm Dr. Helen Caldicott, and in this program we talk about the greatest medical and environmental threats to all life, such as nuclear weapons and nuclear power, global warming, ozone depletion, toxic pollution, deforestation, and many other social and political issues that relate to global well-being. So if you love this planet, keep listening. Today I'm speaking with an environmental activist based in Oak Ridge, Tennessee, Ralph Hutchinson. Ralph is an ordained minister in the Presbyterian Church and has served on state and federal advisory boards related to cleaning up of contamination at the Oak Ridge Reservation and weapons sites across the country. He's also the director of AREPA, the Oak Ridge Environmental Peace Alliance, and Oak Ridge is the home of the Y-12 nuclear weapons plant, birthplace of the bombs that were dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki at the end of the Second World War. AREPA was created in 1988 and uses non-violent action in many forms to affect positive social change. Their ongoing campaign, Stop the Bombs, aims to get information out into the wider community about what is taking place at Y-12. Ralph Hutchinson has lived in Oak Ridge for many years and has worked tirelessly to educate people about the weapons facility there, and he joins us now. I was recently in Oak Ridge as a guest of Ralph and AREPA, and I must say it blew my mind to actually go out to the lab and have a minor glimpse of what that was all about. So welcome to the program, Ralph.
Thanks, Helen. It's nice to be with you on the phone.
Now, there are basically three facilities at Oak Ridge, as I read it. There's the Y-12 plant, I think, encompasses the whole thing. K-25 is where the uranium enrichment took place. And then Oak Ridge National Labs, which is not part of the Oak Ridge Y-12 plant, is composed of a graphite reactor, a HIFAR reactor, and a reprocessing plant, and is run by Oak Ridge National Labs as experimental facilities and to produce isotopes used in industry and medicine. Is that right, Ralph?
I think that's pretty accurate. The gaseous diffusion plant, the old K-25 plant, has been shut down for some time and is in the process that many of the large buildings are being decontaminated and decommissioned and torn down, actually. And the laboratory, which in its early days did weapons work, now does other kinds of research work, including some significant stuff that's not related to weapons at all. I mean, there are what we, in the United States, we have, in our national labs, we have centers of excellence, and they do supercomputing as well at the Oak Ridge National Laboratory.
Yeah, but many of them are, these supercomputers are related to weapons production. Anyway,
that's true.
Let's go on. Oak Ridge was founded very early in the 40s, 1940s, in order to produce material to make nuclear weapons. And indeed, the uranium that was used in the Hiroshima bomb that sort of vaporized and killed about 120,000 people in a flash of light was produced at Oak Ridge, right?
That's right. Oak Ridge was one of the original Manhattan Project sites. And the government here attempted to enrich uranium for the bomb in two different ways. And the way that they were doing it at the Y-12 plant, which was giant cyclotron, turned out to be the fastest way to enrich uranium. And so they collected there the uranium that was used in the little boy bomb that destroyed Hiroshima. And then later we moved our process over to gaseous diffusion because although it took longer to build that plant and it wasn't done by the end of the war, it was ultimately a much more efficient way of enriching uranium. And so it became the method of choice in the United States.
Okay, so we'll go back to the development of the town and what they did there initially, but what I'd like to talk about gaseous diffusion, just for the audience's sake, Uranium, of course, is a raw material that is mined from the ground, and it has two basic isotopes, uranium-238 and 235, and it's 235 which is the fissionable isotope, present in only 0.7%. And it must be enriched to 3% for use in nuclear power, but over 50% or, you know, over 80% actually for bombs. What was the percentage of uranium in the Hiroshima bomb, Ralph?
I don't know how enriched the little boy bomb uranium was. The vast majority of enriched uranium for U.S. atomic and nuclear weapons has an enrichment of over 93%.
Yeah.
The exact number is classified, but we know that it's extremely highly enriched uranium. Yet our country considers anything over 19% enrichment to be weapons grade, meaning you could use it to make a bomb that is conceivably small enough to be transported and, you know, delivered on an enemy target. So it's somewhere in the range of 19 to 93%. Enrichment was the little boy bomb.
Right. So what they did was turn the uranium 235 and 238, once it's been refined from the mining, into a gas called uranium hexafluoride, which is a very potent corrosive substance, and I think also an ozone depleter. And then they built this huge building about a mile and a half long. Would that be right, Ralph?
It's a large horseshoe,
yeah.
About 10 stories of concrete, and yeah. It was a mile from one end of the horseshoe to the other. If you got on a bicycle, which is how they navigated that large building, and you rode from one end of the horseshoe all the way around the ring and up to the other end, you would have traveled a mile. At the time, it was the largest building in the world in the 1950s.
Right. So what they did was fill this building up with cascades of, I think, nickel plates with tiny micropores in them, and forced the gas, the uranium hexafluoride gas, from one side to the other. And on one side stayed the heavier isotope, uranium-238. And through that, those micropores passed uranium-235. But by a series of cascades over a mile long, they were able to enrich uranium-235. Is that a correct reading, Ralph?
That is. And the cascade process means that they had to go through multiple stages. They just did this forcing the uranium through the nickel alloy barrier at high pressures over and over and over again. And each time they managed to separate out a little bit more of the uranium-235, which was what they wanted to do. And they did that at the K-25 building itself, that giant building we talked about. But when they finished there, the material was taken over to the next huge building, which was K-27, and then on to K-29. And it left Oak Ridge and went to Paducah, Kentucky, where it ran through, continuing to run through a series of cascades there, and finally to Portsmouth, Ohio, to the gaseous diffusion plant there, where it was what they called topped off. And then it would reach its final enrichment for use in weapons in the United States. So literally thousands and thousands of repetitions of this enrichment process in order to get the uranium fully separated and have an almost pure uranium-235.
Good Lord. And how big were the metal plates? Can you give us a size and area and thickness of nickel?
I can't tell you very much about the barrier itself. It remains one of the true secrets of nuclear weapons production, the exact nature of that nickel alloy. And so we don't know very much about that. But I have been able to go into the gaseous diffusion facility just to see the size of it. And it's sort of the massive scale of this can really only be conceived by standing there and looking at it. It is overwhelming in its size. Each one of the cascade stages was conducted through huge cylinders, a pair of huge cylinders, and each of those cylinders was easily the size of a good-sized one-car garage. a full building. And that those cylinders were repeated hundreds and hundreds of times. As far as the eye could see, you could see the huge round tops of these cylinders receding into the distance in this building, which, you know, of course, is half a mile long, and so you couldn't see the end of the of the cast pieces.
And also, this process required huge amounts of electricity, and the electricity was obtained from the Tennessee Valley Authority, which is why they located the Oak Ridge Labs right where they were, right?
It was a significant piece of the decision to site this Manhattan Project site here. We were told that at one time the weapons manufacturing process was using a fifth of all the electricity generated in the United States.
Really? And also, it's interesting now that those nickel plates that were used to enrich the uranium, well, nickel's valuable, and the Department of Energy have brought in another regulation called below regulatory concern, deregulating these nickel plates, which of course are radioactive, and they are recycling them into jewelry, belt buckles, braces for children's teeth, hip replacements, cutlery for flatware for tables and furniture. There was a cause to halt that particular process, but I think it's probably ongoing subliminally. So beware of nickel materials, right?
Well, in other nations, I know that at least one proposal that I have seen here for recycling materials from Oak Ridge, the proposal was not to market the materials in the United States because they could not get legal authority to do that. But the proposal said we could ship this stuff to Spain and it could be used to make stainless steel kitchen sinks.
How dare they?
Yeah, all those Spanish, you know. But it's it is an international problem. And even if you can't get permission to market the material in the United States, by the time it goes to Spain and is quote-unquote cleansed in the process, I mean, once this material goes on the market, there isn't any way to track it. It will come back, you know, to the United States or to other countries as well, and it won't be recognized as being radioactive at all.
Yeah, but what about the Spanish? I mean...
Well, you know, our attitude in the United States, if you're not an American, you know...
Well, maybe Obama will change those attitudes. The other thing to note is that this uranium enrichment still goes on at Paducah, Kentucky. Is the Portsmouth plant closed in Ohio?
I think it's just the other way around, Helen. I believe the Paducah, Kentucky plant is closed, and the Portsmouth facility is operating. In our country, the government established a private corporation called the United States Enrichment Corporation and gave this new organization a significant quantity of enriched uranium, which is the way they capitalized it. And so they are in the process of downblending some of our highly enriched uranium and turning it into reactor fuel, and at the same time working hard to build the capacity, build new centrifuges, and develop new capacity for uranium enrichment.
Yeah, well, much of the world's Western world's uranium, including Australia's, is enriched in America, and I got it wrong. I was sure it was Paducah, and the electricity for that is extremely energetic. They require huge amounts of electricity, as I said previously, and there were two 1,500 megawatt coal fire plants to enrich the uranium, which of course caused global warming in its own right. And if you look at the whole life cycle of nuclear power, huge amounts of fossil fuel are used at many stages of the life cycle. So nuclear power contributes substantially to global warming. But look, we're getting off the track.
No, but you're absolutely right about that. And at least in the United States, I'm not sure about Australia or other places, but in the United States, this huge campaign to sort of have a renaissance in nuclear power, and they claim it's a clean and green energy source, but if only if you cut out the whole enrichment trail from the mining up through the enrichment process, which is enormously dirty, and then the waste on the other end is enormously dirty. So there's only one little slice in there where, assuming there's never any accidents, they could make any kind of a claim that they're not polluting while the reactor's operating. And even that's releasing some tritium into the cooling water. It's really a big lie.
It's a total lie, total fabrication, and really criminal. I mean, I think the nuclear industry should be sued and the main operatives put in jail because, you know, they've got a death-producing industry, a carcinogenic industry. I guess to follow that up, you could read my book, Nuclear Power is Not the Answer to Global Warming. But it all started here at the K25 plant. I just want to read, there's a fantastic publication I've just read called A Citizen's Guide to Oak Ridge, which literally made my hair fall out in the last 2 hours. I've developed alopecia areata, which means bald spots. It's been produced by the Oak Ridge Education Project and the Foundation for Global Sustainability. Ralph, where can people download this study, A Citizen's Guide to Oak Ridge?
I think if you did a Google search for the Oak Ridge Education Project, it would probably still come up. I know the Foundation for Global Sustainability has had it on their website for some time. I don't know the exact web address.
Well, it's
for
one of the more profound documents I've ever read. And I think if you extrapolate from the absolute total catastrophic mess that they've made at Oak Ridge, and we'll go through that in a minute, into nuclear power generation, over time, nuclear power generation will produce exactly the same sort of catastrophic contamination and carcinogenic mess as has occurred at Oak Ridge. So bear that in mind as we talk about this mess. And I want to read just one paragraph about the K25 plant where the uranium was enriched. It says more than 21 miles of asbestos-wrapped pipes, and we know now asbestos is highly carcinogenic, 10,000 PCB-contaminated components. PCB is a carcinogenic. 300,000 gallons of oil and 200,000 gallons of coolants, namely chlorofluorocarbons, which are the main destroyer of the ozone layer, await removal and disposal from buildings at the K25 site. In addition, more than 20,000 PCB-contaminated ventilation gaskets and associated ductwork will have to be dealt with. But then, Ralph Hutchinson, let's move on to waste disposal at the K25 site. It says there's the 1070 burial grounds, the 770 burial grounds, the sludge ponds, the underground tanks and lines, and the waste storage facility, and they also incinerate radioactive waste here. I mean, this is like descending into Hades, into hell, right? I've never read anything like it.
If you wrote a script for a good horror film, you'd probably be safe using this as an example, yes.
Well, let's do the 1070 burial grounds. They occupy a 22-acre tract of land to the east of the Oak Ridge gaseous diffusion plant. Wastes are classified if knowledge of them may reveal restricted information like, you know, plutonium, I suppose, and the like. The wastes have been buried since 1975 in unlined trenches, which were then just covered with dirt. No accurate records of materials buried in these trenches were kept. Contaminants have been found in soil, surface water and groundwater. And there's a spring nearby with a strong solvent odour that seeps from the site. I mean, God almighty, these people are so irresponsible. And then you go on to the 770 burial grounds. A 22-acre contaminated scrap metal yard is located within the bend of the Clinch River within the K25 complex. Materials stored there, uranium, PCBs, mercury, asbestos, and this stuff moves into the Clinch River where people take their drinking water. There are sludge ponds used for settling and diluting chemical wastes containing chromium, which is a potent carcinogen, iron oxide, naphthalene, which is a carcinogen, mercury, lead, underground tanks containing huge amounts of stuff. I mean, and it doesn't stop. Then there's a waste storage facility, over 75,000 barrels filled with low-level radioactive and hazardous waste have been stacked in rows 4 deep, 3 feet high on an asphalt pad. Many of the barrels are leaking. And contain, you know, I'm sure they contain plutonium and strontium and God knows what. It just, as a physician, Ralph, it just takes my breath away.
It is mind-boggling, you know, and I think it's interesting because over the years, in an effort to deal with these waste challenges, it's almost to the point of absurdity. On the one hand, with the sludges in the waste pond, there's been an effort to remove the majority of those sludges, and so there is the clear sense that this waste must be contained, that we have to control its migration into the environment, which makes good common sense, I think, to people like you and me. If it does exist, it should be contained. On the other hand, we have these incinerators operating, which are the exact opposite principle, which is, other than the fact that they are used to reduce the volume of the waste to an ash, contamination is spewing out the stack of that incinerator on a regular basis, the exact opposite of containment. Okay, so let's disperse it into the environment and hope that where it falls there aren't kids playing in the dirt or people breathing the air.
Well, I remember you took Jasmine, who is the producer of this program, and me to have a look at the stack of the incinerator. And I read here that the incinerator since 1990 has been burning 9 radioactive elements, including plutonium, cesium and uranium. Now, you don't burn them. You just turn them into gas and shove them out the chimney.
Right.
Plutonium has a half-life of 24,400 years. It lasts for 500,000 years. Less than a millionth of a gram will certainly give you cancer, not just of the lung, liver, lymph glands, bone marrow, testicle and the like. It's the most toxic substance known to the human race. Cesium goes out those stacks that lasts for 600 years and causes muscle cancers and brain cancers. Uranium, and I'm sure strontium, which causes bone cancer and leukemia. And it says here, input capacity for the incinerator is 3,000 pounds per hour. This incinerator is scheduled to burn waste at a rate of 2 million pounds per year with a standard efficiency of 99.9999%. I suppose that means it all burns and goes out the chimney. If DOE meets this best case scenario, best case in italics, the incinerator would be expected to release 200 pounds of particulate matter annually. But, you don't get rid of radiation by putting it in an incinerator. That's absolutely criminal behaviour. These people should be put in jail. I don't believe in capital punishment, but how many people are they killing by distributing these incredibly carcinogenic materials throughout the community, Ralph? And it's a poor community.
Well, and I think one of the real tragedies is, in the time of the Manhattan Project, one of the reasons this location was selected is because they knew they would find a willing workforce. The motto of the state of Tennessee is the volunteer state. And so they came here because they knew they could get people to pitch in and do this work that they at that time thought was necessary to win the war. But the reality then is these same people are dumped on and for economic and other reasons still compelled to continue to volunteer to take this. And so it's the same workforce that is trying to serve the country's interest, at least so far as they understood it, is the workforce that has been poisoned by that same government and continues to be. As that incinerator continues to operate today, they have completed incinerating all of this waste from the Oak Ridge Reservation, and now they have transported waste in from other Department of Energy sites because this is the only incinerator in the United States that's licensed to burn this particularly nasty waste that contains PCB. And one of the reasons it's here in Tennessee is because we're the volunteer state.
Oh, my God. It's being a volunteer to die.
Well, at least to be a guinea pig.
Well, you know, as a physician, how many people have I helped to die? How many children have I helped to die of cystic fibrosis, the most common fatal genetic disease of childhood, which is my specialty? How many children have I watched dying of cancer that we can't cure? How many of my older patients have died of cancer? A hideous, hideous disease. Patients racked with pain. I just saw my dermatologist yesterday, for instance, and he, in Australia, we have a lot of skin cancer because we're exposed to a lot of sun. We're, you know, of Scottish and Irish and English background, so we have very fair skins. These older men in particular come in with skin cancers on their foreheads and their bald scalps. And he said that they often treat these skin cancers, which are very big, with radiation, because many of the patients are on warfarin, which prevents blood clotting because of their heart disease. And because to chop out a huge, you know, area of their scalp is pretty hideous, especially as they'll bleed because they're on warfarin. So they treat them with radiation therapy, which does help to get rid of the cancer. But some years later, some of them are getting second primary cancers on the edge of the radiation field, which are non-differentiated and grow like hell. And he said one of his patients the other day, an older man, died with a secondary cancer in the orbit of his eye. I mean, can you imagine a way to die? And this is really what we're talking about here. And so I have to say most cancers are incurable, particularly in adults. And when you have an incurable disease, we must prevent it. And to allow an industry to operate, which will obviously increase hugely the incidence of cancer, not just now, but for all future generations, is for me as a physician criminal. And this involves the nuclear power industry as well as the weapons industry. The weapons too are still in place, ready to blow up the planet. Of the 30,000 hydrogen bombs in the world today, Russia and America own 97%. And they're still thinking of building more weapons in America. Maybe Obama won't do that. But anyway, I'm raving on, Ralph. I'm sorry. I'm supposed to be interviewing you. But let's move on to the Y12 plant. The Y12 plant was used to create secondaries for hydrogen bombs, separating lithium and combining it with deuterium. Let's now hear an excerpt from a promotional DVD produced by the Y-12 National Security Complex.
This is the Y-12 National Security Complex.
We are absolutely essential to the nation's security because what we do is unique. No one else in the world can do what we do.
The National Nuclear Security Administration recently deemed Y-12 America's Uranium Center of Excellence.
Y-12 plays a key role in the Department of Energy's nuclear weapons complex. Whether we're securing bomb-grade nuclear materials somewhere in the world or developing technologies for the nuclear arsenal of the future.
Occasionally, a technology comes along that's so fundamentally different, it changes the way we think about the world around us. These technologies are called upset technologies. Some examples would be home computers, the cell phone, and GPS. Many of the technologies that are being developed by Y-12 could be considered upset technologies.
We're one of the top manufacturing employers in Tennessee. At the same time, we're creating a Y-12 that is prepared for new and exciting missions on the horizon.
The Y-12 National Security Complex skyline is changing as it prepares to make history as the country's uranium center of excellence. Y-12 is no stranger to making history. Work here brought an end to World War II. Y-12 provided enriched uranium for Little Boy, the first ever uranium bomb, which helped America end a war that had taken 62 million lives worldwide. It was assumed Y-12 had completed its patriotic duty and would close its doors.
The free peoples of the world look to us for support in maintaining their freedom.
But President Harry Truman believed there was still value in the Oak Ridge site. Y-12 soon began to build its reputation as the workhorse of the nuclear weapons complex. And through grit and ingenuity, it would become a cornerstone of America's Cold War posture. Our people are trained for this work, and nobody's better at it.
It's amazing, really. This beautiful Tennessee Valley was chosen during the Manhattan Project for its out-of-the-way location. Today, we are the Uranium Center of Excellence, a world leader in uranium technologies.
That was a small excerpt from the Y-12 promotional DVD titled, This is Y-12. Do you want to talk about the Y-12 plant, Ralph, and the huge industrial complex, and also what is a secondary in a hydrogen bomb? Explain the parts of a hydrogen, the primary, secondary, and tertiary components of a hydrogen bomb.
Well, as we said when we started out, the Y-12 plant originally enriched uranium, and that was its first mission. But when the United States shifted uranium enrichment over to the gaseous diffusion process, the hundreds of, well, that time, the thousands of people who worked at the Y-12 plant either had to find some other way to justify their existence, or they were going to lose their jobs. And so they made a transition at the same time that Edward Teller was developing his theory for the hydrogen bomb, the thermonuclear bomb. Y-12 found a niche, and that niche was to build what is known as the CAN subassembly, or the secondary for the thermonuclear weapon. And to know what that is, you just have to have that basic primer in how a nuclear bomb works. So the nuclear bomb actually has two stages. The first stage, called the primary because it's first, is made out of plutonium and tritium, and it is the trigger of the bomb. It's literally a small atomic bomb, like the bomb that was dropped on Hiroshima and the bomb that was dropped on Nagasaki. That little plutonium bomb, the atomic bomb, is used as a trigger to start a larger reaction. The atomic bomb is a fission bomb. The thermonuclear part of it is a fusion bomb, and so it has many, many, many times the destructive power of an atomic bomb. So the plutonium pit fires and triggered with high explosives, and that reaction generates the neutrons that are driven into the secondary, which is the thermonuclear bomb. At the Y-12 plant in Oak Ridge, they have produced the secondary for every nuclear weapon in the U.S. arsenal, with no exceptions. It's the only facility that we have or have ever had in the United States that makes the thermonuclear secondaries for the bomb.
That's 77,000 secondaries.
Over the years, yep. That's right.
Now, what's the secondary composed of, Ralph? I'm talking to Ralph Hutchinson from OREPA, the Oak Ridge Environmental Peace Alliance, and he is a Presbyterian minister. So what are the components of the secondary?
Well, the exact nature of the secondary, of course, is classified because we don't want you building one in your garage. But we do know that the secondary is composed of highly enriched uranium, of lithium deuteride, so a compound of lithium and deuterium mixed together. We know that there's beryllium in the secondary. And the reason we know that is because there is a cohort of workers at Y-12 who are part of the beryllium cohort, people who are suffering from berylliosis, which is a chronic and sometimes terminal lung disease. We know that also the CAN subassembly has a lot of what is called depleted uranium. That's a pretty misleading term, but it's basically natural uranium with the uranium-235 isotope taken out of it, but it's still, nevertheless, it's highly radioactive. It's depleted uranium. And that serves as a casing for the CAN subassembly. And then they tell us there are other materials, as many as 67 other materials, some of which are adhesives and materials like that, which make up the CAN subassembly.
Well, what is lithium? Where do you get lithium from?
Well, I'm not sure. I mean, you might know that with your science background better than I do. I know that that natural lithium has its isotopic number is 7, and that lithium, in order to bond well with deuterium to make lithium deuteride, it has to be, they call it enriched. They extract the isotope, and they end up with lithium 6, and that is more chemically suitable for bonding with deuterium. And in order to do that process at Y-12 over the years, the actual chemical process, it requires a mercury bath. And that has led to one of the most significant environmental catastrophes in Oak Ridge, was the release, the acknowledgement by the Department of Energy that more than 2 million pounds of mercury, which is a heavy metal, more than 2 million pounds of mercury was, in their words, quote, lost to the environment, which means they can't account for it. And they they do believe that as much as 1 million pounds went into the environment through the water, through the creek, East Fork Poplar Creek, that drains the Y-12 plant. But other significant amounts of mercury were released as mercury vapor into the atmosphere. And one of the boards in which I serve, on which I served for 7 years, was a state panel that was overseeing a study of the health impacts of the historic operations at Oak Ridge. And we determined that the Department of Energy's estimates on how much mercury they had released to the environment were as much as 40% low.
So the mercury, you showed me a creek where these 2 million pounds of mercury were extruded into the creek, and that creek then flows into the Clinch River. Is that accurate?
It does. The creek flows for about 18 miles through the community.
And people's backyards, yeah?
Yeah, alongside the playground where kids play soccer. And every so often, every quarter of a mile or so, there's a sign that says, contaminated, not fit for human contact, no fishing, no swimming. Ultimately, penultimately, but it empties out into the Clinch River, which then empties into the Tennessee River, which travels out of Tennessee, down into Alabama, and back up through Tennessee, and meets up with the Ohio River, and ultimately empties into the Mississippi. The scientists at Oak Ridge National Lab, who studied the contamination in the waterways, said to us years ago, if your Geiger counter was sensitive enough, you could find Oak Ridge in the Mississippi Delta.
I don't know what to say. It just
and what, you know, one of the, for them, one of the interesting ironies was one of the ways they have made an effort to track the mercury contamination to understand where it may be collecting. And, you know, in the uneven bottom of a waterway, there are places where heavy metal like mercury would pool, and you can't find that mercury. But because we also release radioactive materials into the environment, you can find the cesium, which is also pooling in the same places. And so the radioactive contamination in some ways has served as a tracer for other contamination that was released into the water.
And people should know that mercury damages brains. I don't know if you remember the report of the Minamata disease in Japan, where large amounts of mercury were spilt into the sea and bioconcentrated in fish, and people ate the fish, and their babies were born grossly deformed, severely mentally retarded. Mercury was used to cure felt in hats, and the people that made the hats, the milliners, were called Mad Hatters, and there's a Mad Hatter in Alice in Wonderland, if you remember your stories as a child.
Right.
You know, I'm late, I'm late, I'm late for a very important date. Hello, goodbye, can't stop to wait. I'm late, I'm late, I'm late. So that, what they did, I mean, I remember speaking at a huge rally at Rocky Flats once, and it was a very cold day, and I didn't have long to talk, and out of my mouth came this sentence, "We're killing ourselves to make the bombs to kill ourselves better." And that really holds true, doesn't it, Ralph, for Oak Ridge?
I think that's exactly right. You know, one of the phrases we used in our systems guide, we just asked the question, protected or poisoned? Because our government told us these bombs were protecting us. But at the same time, I mean, most graphically at the weapons sites like Rocky Flats and Oak Ridge, where the massive contamination was immediately put into the public arena to expose people, but also through fallout from nuclear testing, global fallout from the nuclear test. We have, under the name of protecting ourselves with these bombs, we have been poisoning
ourselves. Yes, but also the truth is that protection is a euphemism, because in fact we're darn lucky, if you look at the history of the nuclear arms race, not to have blown ourselves up already by accident, not by design so much, although they did talk about using nuclear weapons in Vietnam and Korea and the like. Kissinger threatened to, Nixon threatened to and the like. But, you know, I'm not quite sure actually why or how we're still here, more by luck than circumstance. And the weapons still remain in place, ready to be used. America's still got a policy to fight and win a nuclear war against Russia, which which really seriously disturbs the Russian psyche somewhat. And I know that President-elect Obama has talked about abolishing nuclear weapons, which he could easily do with Russia, because Russia and America own most of them. Let's wait and see and hold our breaths to see if he in fact does that. And on that note, Ralph Hutchison, being a Presbyterian minister and a man of God, I think this is a really reasonable question. What would you say that Jesus would say and do about this situation?
Well, you know, I think the question that's often asked at peace rallies, who would Jesus bomb, is asked not just as a rhetorical question, because we know the answer. In the Christian faith and in many religions that rely on compassion and love as sort of the ultimate goal of the human experience and the highest achievement of our spiritual selves, we recognize at that level anyway that solving our problems by killing people with bombs or in other ways is an offense against God. Certainly it's an offense against spiritual community and against human nature and human dignity.
Yes, well, I want to write a book exploring why men kill, and in particular it usually is men, so we can get into that later. Now, when you go back to Y-12, there are huge waste disposal facilities here too, as well as K-25. In particular, there are the S3 ponds, which some people referred to as the witch's cauldron, unlined pits allowing liquid either to evaporate or percolate through the ground into the headwaters of Bear Creek and East Fork Poplar Creek, containing acids, caustic solutions, plutonium, uranium, and other such things. We've got the boneyard and the burnyard, for heaven's sake, containing 100,000 tons of undocumented refuse, which were burnt and buried in two unlined trenches. The hazardous waste disposal area, the oil land farm site, over 1 million gallons of liquid oily waste were disposed of here, containing beryllium, uranium, tetrachloroethylene, all of which are carcinogenic. The Bear Creek burial grounds, containing 4.8 million gallons of low-level radioactive waste materials. The oil retention ponds, the Kerr Hollow Quarry, and thus it goes on. This is why I really, really suggest that people read this wonderful document, A Citizen's Guide to Oak Ridge. I feel really embarrassed that I've never read it before, even though I visited your area recently, Ralph Hutchison, and gave a talk about Oak Ridge and the preparation of nuclear weapons. But from a medical perspective, we should have this in the New England Journal of Medicine. That's where we should be publishing this material, so my colleagues know why people are getting cancers.
Right, and you know, I would say we created that Citizen's Guide and we modeled it on the Citizen's Guide to Rocky Flats, which had been published a few years before. That's where we got the idea. And we recognized that there was no comprehensive collection of information about Oak Ridge's environmental status and the devastating consequences of weapons production and other research. It was not collected in any one place anywhere, let alone in a format that was accessible to the lay public, so that people who didn't have a degree in chemistry or physics could understand what they were reading. So we undertook that effort and produced the Citizen's Guide to Oak Ridge. I have no doubt that a similar and equally devastating indictment of the practices of the weapons producers could be written about Los Alamos and Savannah River and Hanford and the Idaho facilities. Because it may have been in the earliest days that the people responsible for disposing of these materials just didn't know any better. I got a sense reading the early memos from the health physicists like K.Z. Morgan at the lab that they were learning as they went along, especially with radioactive materials. But there came a time when they did know better, but by then, these what seemed to us astonishingly primitive practices of dumping just into open trenches, it became the way we did it. And rarely did anyone question that. I talked to a scientist once who was interested in environmental stuff, but retired from the Oak Ridge National Lab, and I finally got up the nerve to ask him, how did you feel when you learned about the contamination? And he said, I was embarrassed. I was embarrassed because I always thought, you know, when I finished my work, I wasn't responsible for disposing of the waste. I was responsible for going on and doing more highly technical work, the stuff I was trained to do. So I handed the waste off to people. I just assumed and never checked, but I made the assumption that they were handling it in an appropriate way, and I never dreamed they would just pour it down the drain. But in fact, that's what a lot happened to a lot of this stuff. It was just poured down drains, out of sight, out of mind. And you know, from the medical standpoint, I think one of the real challenges of getting people to understand the dangers of radioactivity is you don't feel the harm when you're exposed to it. You can't taste it. You can't see it. And because of the latency period, it might be 7, 10, 20 years before you develop the cancer. So people feel like they weren't harmed during the actual exposure itself. And I think that sort of attitude permeated the whole nuclear industry and to some extent still does today. And it lulls the public into this false sense of security that enables the industry to push on and do the stuff that it does, which seems to us, you know, so barbaric.
Well, I think you've put that very well, Ralph. I couldn't have put it better. I just want to move on to the Oak Ridge National Labs. That's also part of this area where they had nuclear reactors. They were making plutonium and separating it from radioactive waste. It now is run, I believe, by the it works with the University of Tennessee, right? They've sort of separated it off from the whole Y12K25 plant. Is that right?
Right. The University of Tennessee formed a consortium with Battelle, who came out of the Hanford facility, and they formed a consortium to manage the lab. So they have a separate management contract for ongoing operations. The cleanup side of the ledger, though, Bechtel Jacobs Corporation is responsible for cleaning up at all the Oak Ridge facilities, and they subcontract some of that out. You know, there's a big contract with BNSL, British Nuclear Fuels, to do some of the work at K25.
Yeah, well, I also know when I wrote my book, The New Nuclear Danger, about the new weapons production plans, that Oak Ridge National Labs is very much involved in the design of new nuclear weapons and also in the, quotes, renaissance of nuclear power. And for that, I really hold them guilty. I mean, the next meltdown in America will probably kill thousands, if not more, people, and that'll be the end of nuclear power. But Oak Ridge National Labs have been leading this push. As well as this, and they've the most dirty site, I think, on the whole reservation is at Oak Ridge National Labs, is burial ground number one containing strontium, burial ground number two containing unknown numbers of drums containing beta and gamma contaminated waste and plutonium, burial ground three with 56,000 curies, alpha radiation, beta, gamma, strontium, plutonium, burial ground four with 2 million cubic feet of waste and a radioactive inventory of 110,000 curies, burial ground five with transuranic waste, which is plutonium-related material, which is so carcinogenic, 90% of DOE's total inventory of remote-handled transuranic waste like plutonium is stored in below-ground bunkers at burial ground 5. Then there's burial ground 6 with 500 unlined trenches and 550 holes that have been drilled for the disposal of high-level radioactive waste just put in the ground. Then there's burial ground 7 with similar materials, waste pits and trenches. I guess I've never really read anything like this. And then underground tanks, 98 tanks full of radioactive liquid, some of which are empty now, but many containing radioactive waste, single steel hulls which are leaking God knows what into the ground. I mean, this site should be shut down. It should be shut down. And I know that when we were there, Ralph, there were a lot of sort of funny looking triangular things, which were pumps or areas where they were testing the underground water. That's right too, isn't it?
Right. There are over 1,800 monitoring wells located around the Oak Ridge Reservation because the water table is about 18 inches. So the difference between contaminating surface water and groundwater is 18 inches.
18 inches below the surface? Oh, my God.
Right. So there's an effort to try to track the around the circumference, the perimeter of the plant, to try to find out where materials are going. But, I mean, the reality is if you sat down and said, let's design the absolutely worst possible waste disposal method and locate them in the absolute worst possible places, you probably could not have come up with a design as wretched as what we developed here willy-nilly. I mean, many of those waste area groups that you described are on the downhill slope of a hill that is leading down to the creek, so that every time it rains, the rain itself flushes contaminants are constantly leaching into the White Oak Creek, and then farther downstream in the White Oak watershed, they are emptied into White Oak Lake, which the state of Tennessee declared most likely the most radioactive lake in the United States.
Or maybe the world.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think other than the fact that we don't know all of the contamination, all the waste practices in the former Soviet Union in Russia,
yeah.
Although from talking with officials there, they have horror stories that match ours.
Yep.
It's not a competition you want to win.
No.
But we're neck and neck with them. So I don't know that I'd make the global claim, but certainly in the United States, yeah.
How large is the whole reservation, the Y-12, the K-25, and the Oak Ridge National Lab all together? What's the area, Ralph Hutchison?
Originally, it was 900 square miles.
Mm.
The perimeter's been reduced a little bit. In order to turn over some of the outlying areas that were never contaminated but were sort of a buffer zone for security reasons. Some of those have been turned over to private industries to be developed. But, you know, in some cases, the private industry that comes in is an industry that wants to work on waste, and so they build an incinerator, they build a waste packaging plant, and they get some contracts from Oak Ridge to handle some of the waste that's being dredged up from the past. But in order to maintain their business, they also import waste from other states to burn in the incinerator here.
Jesus.
Compounds the impact on the local community.
One last question as we proceed is what impact is the Oak Ridge Environmental Peace Alliance having on this whole environmental catastrophe? And do you get much media attention in order to educate people, Ralph Hutchison?
Well, over the years, we've had considerable media attention, both in the local area, where it's very important because there are many people who live in this immediate area who don't understand what Oak Ridge does. It is still, in many ways, the secret city that it was during the Manhattan Project.
Yeah, it's a secret city.
Yeah, but we have sometimes national, regional and national media attention as well. You know, sometimes the question you ask is a question that I ask myself. How much good is all of this doing? All of the people that work as part of the alliance and the time and energy we put in. I mean, the first thing I would say is I'm absolutely confident that things would be much worse if we weren't here. So in the sense of restraining evil, I think we accomplished some there. But there have also been things like when we first disclosed in 1991, that there was plutonium in the Watts Bar Reservoir in the Clinch River. And the Department of Energy study had been prepared and then had been quietly put on the shelves. And somebody leaked information to us that this study had been done. And we requested and got a copy of it because it was a public document. The scientist who prepared it was actually pleased with his work and was glad it was getting some attention. But when we went through it and discovered that it documented the fact that there was plutonium in this reservoir, which is the largest recreational lake in the state of Tennessee.
Oh, my God.
You know, little alarm bells went off in our head. And when we finally sat down, and the Department of Energy said, well, we're not going to discuss that with you until we talk with the downstream community. Well, when are you going to do that? Well, probably not until the end of the summer. In other words, after the recreation season. So the next night, we took a local television crew out, in a little boat, and we showed them where the waste stream left the Oak Ridge Reservation and literally pulled a chain up out of the water that had a radioactive, a keep out sign dangling from it, and you had to wipe the algae off to see that it had a radioactive symbol. Well, when that hit the news, the Department of Energy called the next day and said, all right, let's meet and talk. And in the course of that conversation, one of the things we learned was that many of these contaminants were trapped in sediments. Mm. And as we discussed that, we learned that they had never restricted dredging in the main channel of the Clinch River, which meant this stuff could be resuspended in the water and flushed downstream at any time. And so out of that conversation in one afternoon, they got on the phone with the Army Corps of Engineers and the Tennessee Valley Authority, and they said no permits for dredging the main channel of the Clinch River. None whatsoever. So that was one positive thing that happened as a direct result of what we were doing. There are lots of other stories about people reading reports or seeing things on CNN and calling us to talk about, you know, what might have happened to them when they lived here, or people calling to find out about where to look for property and stuff like that. So we know that our message gets out. We know that people see it and they hear it, and some people are inclined to respond. And I think everybody, you know, when you know someone's looking over your shoulder, you just behave better because you don't want to get caught doing something wrong. And so I think maintaining a sort of vigilance over the facility is crucially important.
Well, Ralph Hutchison, I have to doff my cap to you and say that you truly walk in the shoes of the fishermen. For that, I'm very grateful to you, as I'm sure millions of other people are, and the people with whom you work in the Oak Ridge Environmental Peace Alliance. So thank you very much for coming on our program and giving us such an enlightened interview, if somewhat terrifying, and let's proceed with our work towards a peaceful and relatively safe world.
Well, Helen, thank you for having me on. It's a great honor to be a colleague in this work, and I really appreciate having the chance to talk with you.
Thank you, Ralph. Today I've been speaking with the director of the Oak Ridge Environmental Peace Alliance in Tennessee, Ralph Hutchison. For more information on their Stop the Bombs campaign and what is going on at the Y-12 nuclear weapons facility in Oak Ridge, go to stopthebombs.org. And if you would like to access this wonderful report, A Citizen's Guide to Oak Ridge, Google the Foundation for Global Sustainability, Foundation for Global Sustainability website, and you will find the Citizen's Guide to Oak Ridge on that. If you would also feel impelled to support this program, if you go to ifyoulovethisplanet.org, you can certainly contribute financially to us. We need to be sustained financially to keep this show on the road, so to speak. Thanks all for listening. Talk to you next time.
You've been listening to If You Love This Planet with Dr. Helen Caldicott. This program is broadcast on community radio across the United States, including our host station, KPFT Pacifica, Houston, Texas. This program is produced and engineered by Jazz Williams, co-produced by Scott Powell, and our publicity and outreach are coordinated by Amanda Bellerby. To listen to previous shows or to make a donation, go to our website, ifyoulovethisplanet.org.